There goes Terry Flanagan. Thank you very much indeed. And indeed, thank you to the trees, not just for the beautiful colours they give us. Oh no, there's so much more to be grateful for. In her new book, The Genius of Trees, British tree consultant Harriet Ricks explores the beauty and majesty and wonder of trees. She spoke with Aidan Ilona earlier.
Aina, thank you so much for having me on the programme. It's lovely to speak to you today.
And it's great to talk to you too, Harriet, and to discuss your most interesting book, which is called The Genius of Trees. And this is an approach to trees that I haven't encountered before. Trees, you're saying, shaped the world, not vice versa. It wasn't the world that shaped trees. You say that trees began in the Devonian period, which is 400 million years ago, and that they were the first plants on Earth. There were no plants on Earth until these primordial early trees came out, and they had an impact on what they found. So we could go through the different chapters that you have. Now, the first one is soil. So they came out of, they evolved on in the Devonian period, and there was the soil. Now, the soil at this very early stage was just broken down, if you like, pieces of rock. Your trees then were on this bare rock, broken down into small particles, and they effectively turned it into soil. So what did the trees do to this to make it into the soil as such?
Well, there were about three things that the trees did, which I discuss more in my book. The first was that they used mechanical action. So the power of a tree root into a bit of rock is approximately equal to a sort of stiletto heel on the back of being worn by an elephant. So if you can imagine that very gentle looking root tip putting this extreme amount of pressure on rocks to break them up into smaller and smaller pieces, physically, that is what every tiny little root that was starting to develop in the Devonian was doing. And the other thing that trees do extremely well is to develop mutualisms. So they will develop relationships with bacteria and with fungi, which allow them to have this amazing chemical effect on rock. And then they'll use those same chemicals themselves. So they were doing these three things from very early on, about 380 million years ago, if not earlier. They were using their root tips to force through the rock and break it up mechanically into tiny, tiny pieces, such that it was a sort of dust effect. And then they were binding it together. They were binding the soil up, both with the things that they encouraged bacteria and fungi to exude. So a sort of gooey, syrupy paste that bound it all together. And then with the, also by exuding things themselves. So they send little carbon chains out into the dust, into the sand, and use that to bind the grains together and make this sort of much more retentive soil. So rather than dust and sand, you get this sort of gooey, carbon-rich effect.
Yes, indeed, we can imagine that. And of course, they were all evergreen trees. We didn't actually get deciduous trees until very recently, relatively speaking, 65 million years ago, as opposed to 400 million. So that's fair enough. Soil is fairly evident. But now you move on to the chapter on water. And you, if I haven't, I've read it several times, I'm not imagining it, you say that trees actually can call down rain. The trees can make the rain happen. How does that happen? How can the trees call down rain?
This, for me, was one of the most extraordinary things that I found out while I was writing the book, because I had this vague idea. You know, I knew that trees transpire a lot. They release a lot of water. And that's so that they can suck nutrients from the soil up to their very top branches. But what I hadn't really grasped was the way that they also managed to, they can't create moisture in the air out of nothing. But what they can do is force the moisture in the air to become rain and then sort of cycle it into continental interiors. So in the Amazon, you get these amazing flying rivers, they're called. They're a sort of current of moisture inland. And that's because trees are releasing chemicals which go up into the atmosphere where the moisture from which has evaporated off the sea is. And they sort of seed rain like you would seed a pearl. Or there's this little carbon ring and around it cluster all these water molecules. They get heavier and heavier. More and more water molecules will cluster to the carbon and then it'll fall as rain. And then the trees underneath the rain will then, of course, pick that up and the whole thing begins again. So I think for me, one of the great revelations was not that trees were just releasing water, which then came down as rain, but that they were using these chemicals to sort of create a cloud out of what would otherwise be a fairly blue sky.
So then, the leading on from that, then deforestation then leads to drought, because when there are no trees to do this, even though the rivers of water are up there, there's nothing to call it down. So deforestation is having a huge impact on the amount of rain that falls in places when the trees are gone.
Yes, and one of the sort of things which is one of the great mysteries of science, which is still being solved, still being unpicked, is this extraordinary idea that if you deforest near the coast, you can dry out the whole of a continental interior. And this is still a mystery. It's still something that people are arguing about. It's still a big happening debate in science, because the idea that trees would cycle water inland, that if there are trees near the coast, they can essentially then push, help the water get into the continental interior. It's a really confusing idea for lots of people. And because it doesn't, in some ways, it doesn't make that much sense. But in other ways, if you think of it as a lot of cycling inland, it does make sense. And the physics for it is still very much under debate. But the sort of factual basis for it seems quite firm. So the evidence on the ground is there. The theoretical evidence is still being debated.
One of the big coastal trees is actually mangroves. And the mangroves that grow all around the coast in lots of places are being removed because of people using these areas to grow prawns for people to eat in further away places. So is this having a huge impact then on the amount of water? I mean, if the mangroves are gone, you have no coastal protection, and you can understand that the tidal surges will be worse. But will it affect the water as well?
100%. And I think it's a massive problem. I think it's a massive tragedy. And it's happening everywhere in the world, from Brazil to Pakistan, that these mangrove swamps that have been sucking up water by the coast, they've been protecting the coast, they've been desalinating water themselves. And they also are such an important link in this cycling of water inland. You can, my father has a story that he was flying in a tiny little biplane over the coast of Africa with my uncle, who was a very keen pilot. And as they passed the mangrove swamps, you could feel this kind of amazing downdraft on you, which was the absorption of the sun, the black absorption of the sun from the mangroves. And that sort of effect that trees have on the atmosphere and on the air is one of the really awful, awful things that we're losing every time we destroy a mangrove and, as you say, set up these intensive farms, which can be so environmentally destructive.
Now, one of the things that's really bad for trees, anybody might say, is fire. If there's fire, the tree is burnt, end of tree. And yet you have a whole chapter on this, and you say that trees actually shape fire, that the trees themselves have evolved or are in some state or able to control fire to their own advantage. Now, how could a tree control fire to its advantage? Surely anybody thinking about this would say fire and trees, they're at the opposite ends. One is bad for the other. And you have a whole chapter saying this is not the case. So make the case for how the trees actually shape fire.
Trees lock down carbon dioxide. And as a result, the oxygen levels will always peak when there are lots of trees. And that means that every time trees have been very successful in the world, there have been high oxygen levels. Other things have caused it as well, of course, but high oxygen means that there's a very pyrogenic, there's a very burning environment going on. And so what I feel, or what I know, is that trees, over the years of their evolution, have had to deal with this very burny environment over and over again. Now, because of climate change, they're now facing that in a more severe way. And so we're seeing terrible forest fires that just outstrip anything that a tree might, any condition that a tree might have evolved under, the conditions of extreme heat and extreme drought, where trees find it very hard to cope. But in some cases, something like the pine tree, for example, is a really good example of where a tree has evolved so that when drought strikes and when the tree is stressed, and this whole forest of pines, imagine a hillside of pines in Greece, when they're having a very bad time, they've had very little water, they've had lots and lots of sun, they will change their metabolic pathways just slightly so that they produce these very inflammable substances, things which will burn at low temperatures. And that allows them to get one over on the other trees that they grow with. Because what is happening there is that these alcohol rings or these very small, very inflammable substances can cause a sort of mist of fire around the tree. And so when there's a storm and there's a lightning strike, or nowadays, of course, it might be a cigarette or a barbecue that someone's left unattended. But if that spark happens, then the whole pine forest can burn very fast, very quickly, at a very fast rate. And this, for the pine tree, is a really good way of liberating nutrients and getting the next generation going, because the pine cone will hang on the tree, it's sort of glued up with some resin, and when the heat of a fire comes past, it'll melt the resin, the pine tree will drop its seeds, and it'll fall on this sort of bed of ash, which will be rich in nitrogen and potassium and phosphorus and all the things that the pine needs to exist. And also, hopefully, by this point, there will have been a storm. The smoke particles will go up and seed a cloud, and there will be a rain torrent. And that means that the seeds of the next generation of pine tree have a really, really good chance of growing well, whereas other trees that aren't adapted in the same way will burn and die. And the example that I find most neat, obviously fire is a very hard tool to use if you're a tree. It's an extremely dangerous business to evolve that sort of pyrogenicity, as they call it. But a really good example is where you see pines and fir trees growing together in Europe. This isn't the same in America, it's different in America. But in Europe, where you have pine trees and fir trees growing together, you get a sort of battle of fire, where the pine is trying to destroy the fir, so it has lots of growing space, lots of water, lots of nutrients. And the fir is fighting back by creating these very fire-retardant chemicals, very long, unburnable chains of carbon. And the same is true. Walnuts, for example, will produce this unburnable chain of substances. And the reason that pine wants to start this fire, as it were, is that the pine cones will hang on the tree, and then when the fire comes through, the goo that connects, that the is gluing up the pine cones, will force them to pop open. The seeds will fall on the ash, which is very rich in nitrogen, phosphorus, and other nutrients, and they'll be given a head start by this kind of confluence of all the things that they need to grow coming together. And the result is that they can then outgrow their competition. The problem with this is that pine and eucalyptus, which is another tree that grows extremely fast after a fire and will sort of invoke a fire by producing these very flammable chemicals. That's why the Blue Mountains in Australia are called the Blue Mountains, because eucalyptus releases such a haze of inflammable chemicals over them that they look blue. And the problem with this is that because they grow so fast, that's often what humans choose to have as their forest. Because they're fast-growing trees, they think wonderful, or even for shade, they think fantastic. This tree will grow extremely fast in a hot country, and it'll be just what I need in 10 years' time. But the trouble then is you're storing up problems for yourself in the future.
The next chapter you have, and this is, I suppose, we could all say, well, we can understand this. Trees shape air. Trees, after all, carry out photosynthesis. They take the CO2 molecule, they save up all the carbon, they give out all the oxygen. So way back when insects came and life evolved on Earth after the trees, there were 2,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the air and huge amounts of oxygen. And the trees, by growing in the 350 million years of the Carboniferous era, brought it back down to 200 parts per million from 2,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide. And this meant, of course, that because there was so much oxygen in the air, Creatures were huge. Insects were absolutely enormous. Dragonflies, all the insects that were there, we see these in fossils in Germany and places like this, enormous things. And this presumably was unimaginable to the people who found those fossils in the 17 and 1800s. How could they have existed then and not now? So trees shaping air is what they do. And as a consequence, the insects of the world got smaller and smaller.
Yes.
That's a pity, or is it?
I think it's a tragedy. I would have loved to see the huge insects of the Carboniferous. But I think the trouble is, I think they were on the wane anyway. I think their time was over. I think shifting continents had a role to play in their demise, as well as this lack of oxygen in the air. And I think as you look at a tree and you see this carbon dioxide sort of incorporated in it, it's hard to imagine it being surrounded by the swarming of huge insects. But I suppose if we burned all the coal, which had shut down all that carbon, then maybe we can get them back in a dystopian world of the future. I don't know whether they'd evolve back in time, but it would be interesting to see it.
And of course, where would that leave us? There were no mammals around then. But there's a whole new theory, it seems to be, when we talk about trees and fungi, that trees are actually able to communicate with each other through fungi. Is that a belief? Is that a fact? Where do you stand on one tree talking to another and saying, things are rough over here, lads, we better put out more toxins or something because the fungi have told us in our roots? Or am I on the wrong track there altogether?
It's still being debated by people. And I think one of the problems has been that it was such a compelling idea that it's been slightly lost in translation, because the idea that trees will send nutrients to one another through fungi is fantastic. Are they talking while they're doing it? I think then often people are getting into, or we're getting into, a sort of anthropomorphization, which can be destructive. However, having said that, I think one of the fascinating things that people are finding out more and more, and Merlin Sheldrake, whose very good book, Entangled Life, is a real, real, really brilliant read, has put this idea very, very clearly that it's perhaps not talking, but it might be more to do with balancing out. So trees, more than anything, are amazing at cooperation in some way. Yes, they will fight and kill each other with chemicals, but they'll also cooperate in some ways. And even if that is just a balancing out of nutrients for the overall health of the forest, that's no bad thing. I think the strange thing about honey fungus, of course, is that it's one of the most common mushrooms. It's one of the most, and you can see its caps, you know, the sort of honey-coloured little bundles of mushrooms at this time of year, very clearly everywhere. And the networks that it forms can stretch for miles and miles and miles across hectares. But the strange thing about it is, in that situation, it's forming lots of links with trees. It's killing some of them. Is it doing a sort of balancing act that the trees have in some way endorsed? Or is there really a massive fight going on there under the surface? And so the two camps of the wood wide web, sort of for and anti, so some of the people who worked on the initial wood wide web paper have come out and said, this is massively overinterpreted. This is all completely, we're theoreticizing ahead of our data. There are trees that don't form any connections with mushrooms at all, and they're fine. So what are we doing with fungi at all? And they're fine. So what are we doing? Making up this idea that everything is connected by these underground networks. And I think that's fine, but there's also very good evidence to show that they sometimes are connected. And so it might be one of those situations where, and a lovely example is an oak tree. If an oak tree suffers from a certain disease, then what it can mean is that some of its, or it seems to be that some of its mushroom partners, some of its fungal partners from further away, aren't operating with it anymore. And that can cause it to sicken and die. So in a sense, it can be like, it can be more that the whole system is so reliant on mycelium networks, it's so reliant on fungi, that that shutting it down is always going to be a terrible thing, even if it's something that has developed very gradually to the extent that trees don't actually need it. They just then come to rely on it, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Harriet Ricks and Enid Lana, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for tonight. Don't forget to visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. We'll do it all again next week at the same time. Until then, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
Email Mooney@rte.ie.